Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
If you can't name that tune by this many notes, you shouldn't even be on this program. Chris Woodbridge, name that tune.
Born to Run.
There you go. You could be on the program. And you've got a new computer, and it actually worked.
I know. High adventure.
Well, congratulations. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, thanks.
I hope
we had a good one out there, too.
Oh, yeah. Everybody in this age of COVID, everybody did. Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I was actually down in Virginia Beach, Virginia. First time for my niece to actually host that sort of a dinner get-together event. So, again, a little high adventure,
On a number of fronts.
Well,
good for you. Let's talk current events. Do you want to be critical of General Mattis? Come on. Don't be afraid. Come on. Okay, so let me ask you this. In my opinion, he wrote an op-ed last week. And let me just tell you, if you're afraid to criticize him, and I'm not talking to you, Woody. I said this an hour one, too. I mean, he wouldn't respect you. He likes intellectual, right, articulous, rigorous discourse, okay? And so he would certainly, right, engage with us if he allowed us in the room. But in my opinion, the audio is not matching the video. He says it's America alone, but I look in the Western Pacific, we're doing more than we've done. I can't tell you the last time we did this much stuff with our allies, engaged in Taiwan, Palau inviting us in, engaged in the Indo-Pacific with India, Australia, Japan, holding larger exercises than we've ever held, right? In NATO, in Europe, we're further east than we've ever been. NATO members are contributing more to the collective defense. And I understand the president's bedside manner sucks, right? But I'm curious about your comments about that. I was a little bit surprised at the whole America alone thing because, to me, the audio is not matching the video. Care to comment?
I don't disagree with you at all. I think there's some layers of complexity in that discussion, and I really believe that so much of the general's comments are really criticism of the current administration's foreign policy as a whole, not necessarily a national defense policy, not necessarily focused in any one region, but there is a school of thought that our collective, our national standing in the world is damaged by a, call it a populist, neo-isolationist view summarized as America first. It sets a bad example in the world. And I think that's what the general was getting at. Regionally specific, I also think he's more concerned, frankly, with our relationship with long-standing allies, particularly in Europe, and the damage done there, perceived damage, that over the last 4 years or 3.5 years, with regard to the EU and by extension NATO, General Mattis will and has in the past, waxed very, very eloquent about the nature of that relationship, really dating back to the end of World War II and even beyond, the peril of damaging that relationship, and that peril is more than military. When you look at the when you look at the GDP of the entire planet Earth, okay, divided in half of that to this day is the U.S. Half of the other half is the EU. That remaining quarter is divided up amongst the ROW, the rest of the world. And so regardless of what's going on in the Western Pacific, in terms of economic interest, trade interest, and just resources, the EU as a whole, and it's not homogenous, but the EU as a whole is second only to the United States. Who do you want to stay friends with in schoolyard talk? Who do you want to keep on your team, on your good side? The neo-isolationist approach, and a very myopic, what I'll call a transactional approach. You know, I give this, I get that. I pay this, you pay that. That sort of approach to foreign policy, I believe, and I think the general is making that point, has damaged our standing in the world. So, all that said, you know, I agree, and I'm very concerned looking ahead at what the next national security strategy, national defense strategy are gonna articulate, and how they're going to characterize the People's Republic of China.
Let me amplify my questions because I appreciate your nuanced discussion there, and actually a little bit surprised by it, being the knuckle dragger that you are. So, Woody, would you ever have envisioned a day when you would read a headline that says Saudi Arabia is on the verge of recognizing Israel, but drug its feet because of the uncertainty associated with the new administration that is coming into power? And that you would see a world where Israel would be aligned with the Arab states in an effort to further isolate Iran. I mean,
this is a really fascinating nuance.
Right.
And this is something that I find very encouraging, and also potentially, you know, fraught with risk, as all international relations are.
Right.
The Rubik's Cube of peace in the Middle East has been the unsolvable problem
in our lifetime, right?
Problem since 1949,
right?
Since before our problem, and it's not about Israel; it's all about Israel. The what I'll call the traditional diplomatic and security approaches have not really moved the football to solve that problem, other than to a degree, individual bilateral agreements not to try to wipe each other off the face of the earth, and a sort of a modern era of mutual assured destruction, albeit, you know, perhaps without nuclear weapons. What's interesting is the indirect approach that has actually gained ground in the last year. And the indirect approach has been through their pocketbooks. and in a lot of ways, it's really just sort of coming out of the closet about the love affairs that have been going on in terms of trade and economics for decades, particularly between the Gulf states and Israel. So Bahrain, UAE, those very transactional relationships as the basis for normalization of diplomatic relations. So that's sort of an indirect approach to solving that problem. And the other big dogs in the room, one needs to get in the house, and that's the land of the two holy mosques, the kingdom. The other one that has to be reckoned with is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Prior to the Iranian Revolution, Iran and Israel were trading partners and not necessarily allies, but had a much closer diplomatic relationship than any of the other Arab states.
Right.
And the Iranians saw that as a way to counterbalance the Arab influence in that region. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I think the chalk line is being snapped, but the point that you made at the beginning that there's hesitancy now because of how the new administration is going to treat Israel is a real fly in the ointment.
That a Biden administration might, it seems like, rescue Iran from this failing. Say they face currently American sanctions. Europe is not pleased with Iran, right? The price of oil, right, has not been kind. You have, you know, the Middle East, you know, solidifying in one front against them. And the thought that we would open a door and let them off the hook for this is like, no, God, I would never have foreseen this in my life that Saudi Arabia would recognize Israel. And now in some way, shape or form, they will be let off the hook for that. So as you said, it's full of nuance and fraught with danger. And it'll certainly be interesting, but man, I hope that because, you know, and I'll ask you another question about China in the same way. India, Japan, Australia, right? The United States, Japan, right? I said Japan mm-hmm. already, and South mm-hmm. Korea, in many cases, operating in concert. You know, we just did the largest exercise we've ever done with India, Japan, and Australia, you know, here last month. And mm-hmm. the one next year, you know, I've heard is going to be like three or four times that size. You're seeing, you know, Mr. Duterte now openly say that, you know, thank the United States for selling its arms so that they can fight the, you know, the Islamic separatists that, you know, in an ongoing war, you know, inside the Philippines. Mr. Duterte wouldn't come anywhere near us a year ago. You have, you know, Palau inviting us in, you know. And so you see concert in the Pacific. Like, I don't know that I've ever seen it in my lifetime. And, you know, and that is, make no mistake, right, the most deadly course of action that the Chinese face is concert. And you just had, you know, what, this week, NATO published a paper that says we have to get serious about China. So if NATO's contribution is economic power and the rest, what China is now beginning to face is concerted actions by the free nations of the world, which is the most deadly course of action for them. And so I would hope that, you know, we would not see a Biden administration, you know, turn left or right, do anything other than keep their foot on the pedal of the inertia. Now, the problem with that is you have to acknowledge that, you know, the State Department in both these areas has done good things. And that seems compliments like that seem, I don't know, non-existent, few and far between, might be too kind. But give me your thoughts on that. I mean, it seems like kind of the same looming situation for the Chinese.
So, you know, your characterization of that coalescence of large and small, you know, nations in concert, call it a policy of containment, call it simply a policy of non-compliance with the greater PRC plan, and a desire to maintain their independent ways of life outside of a totalitarian communist state, which China still is.
Right.
It's fundamentally, you know, anathema to Western democracy, and so. Whatever flavor of Western democracy you happen to be looking at, that ain't China. I think that is certainly their most dangerous course of action. Their biggest threat, and I think they will, in some ways, regardless of what the new administration does, they're going to work to counter that. And it will most likely be a divide and turn. Means or methodology for affecting that. You'll also, I think, see them start to appear more heavily in other parts of the world. I think you're going to see almost an effort to call it remove the target, and you'll see more Chinese influence in Africa, in the Caribbean and Latin America, as they go around us, essentially.
Right.
So now as far as what the administration's policy is going to be about that, I have no idea. I suspect that you can get a pretty good insight into it by researching foreign policy from the Obama administration. I think there's going to be a lot of recycling.
God save the Queen. I want to ask you another big announcement on Monday. The Navy announced a decision that they would decommission and scrap the USS Bonhomme Richard. But to me, the part of that decision that has the biggest impact on Marine Corps is "and not replace it."
Right.
That is not
a, exactly.
What do you like? God damn it! What do you laugh? That wasn't. There's no punchline in that.
Nervous laughter. I'll tell you that. This is absolutely shocking to me. First of all, that the loss of a capital ship is kind of buried below the fold on page 3.
Not so much the mention of arson either.
No public discussion of any facts out of the investigation that I've found in any open source documents.
Right.
And the investigation may well be ongoing, but the simple fact is we don't have a lot of spare amphib ships.
Now that was worthy of a laugh, and and the proverbial rim shot, for the love of God, Woody, there you go. You want to say that again?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of spare amphib ships, and so the idea of losing one and a big deck with a well deck
that's been retrofitted for the F-35, right?
Yes. Big deck with a well deck, so not an America class big deck. Big deck with a well deck that will not be replaced. There's not a lot of depth on the bench. There's no slack in that inventory, and so we already really can't meet the requirements of naval forward positioning with amphibious forces. We already can't do that. Which is essentially why we are well down the road now, almost 10 years down the road, on special purpose MAGTAFs, sprinkled throughout the Mediterranean and the Arabian Gulf. So
could you explain what you just said? The special purpose MAGTAF normally does not exist outside of amphibious operations, right?
No, not necessarily.
Could you explain that?
What I meant by that is SP, our current first of all, special purpose MAGTAF implies that it is put together for a special purpose, perhaps on a limited basis, and not as a standard approach to deployment and employment of Marine forces. However, we crossed that river again about 10 years ago after Benghazi, when there was no Marine Expeditionary Unit in the Mediterranean. Therefore, there were no Marines available to respond as one of those core missions of a Marine Expeditionary Unit. And so without the amphibious lift capability, there's no way to reconstitute that. And so the answer became and has been sustained as making special purpose MAGTAFs not that special anymore. Something that we are doing as a standard approach to forward positioning, forward deploying Marine forces for employment, often across combatant commander boundaries. So distributed operations, both at land and in multiple nations in multiple AORs. The argument can be made that the only real driver behind that, particularly in the Mediterranean, has been the shortage or the paucity of available amphibious ships. And so that just got worse by, a composite squadron, battalion minus reinforced, elements of a MEU service support group or MEU CLB, Combat Logistics Battalion. That shortage just got worse and apparently not going to get fixed. So expect, I think, more deployment and employment as SP MAGTAFs.
By necessity, right? There's
not by design, right, by necessity.
Another facet of that was when you read the discussion of the reasons not to repair the Bon Armor Shard. I mean, because again, as Woody said, and again, I don't know if everybody understands everything that we talk about, but an American class big deck is different because it doesn't have the well deck, right? And so, what you're talking about is you're talking about the bigs, to use a kind of a sports terminology. Right. So the bigs, and the other part of that, one of the rationales for it was if we attempt to repair it, it would take between 4 and 7 years, something like that, and it would crush our ship construction infrastructure, and the opportunity cost in terms of other ships being produced is more than the Navy can take, which paints a bit of a picture, Woody, about our ship construction infrastructure, which is also quite alarming.
I think the reality is that is more of a threat to national security than the loss of the single ship is. When it becomes too hard to fix, and doing that work is limited by or is impacted by such limited shipbuilding capabilities. That should be an indicator that, we as a country may not be the naval power that we think we are, that the rest of the world thinks we are. This is a strategic impact, a strategic loss, if you will. And again, that it's lost on the majority of folks. So it's not front page news. This is buried somewhere, and I think that also is an issue of national security that the American people are so ignorant of what affects our standing in the world and our ability to tout ourselves as the sole remaining superpower. When the sole remaining superpower is no longer a naval power, then it's a paper tiger. I'm very disheartened by that. It concerns me greatly, and there ought to be hue and cry.
Let me kind of amplify an email that I just got, not admonishing me, but encouraging me. It says, Mac, last hour you spoke of the Marine Corps coming off the 38 ship requirement that it has held to for decades. Make sure you ask Woody that question. So, Woody, where does that leave the Marine Corps? I mean, in a state of uncertainty we just lost a major, as you said, cannot overstate the significance of this loss and the decision not to rebuild. And yet the Marine Corps has come off the 38 ships with the Commandant's forces, new force design. Right. Yet we've seen no guarantees. As you say, there's the amphibious platforms are getting fewer. Where does that leave the Marine Corps right now?
Well, the movement away from the 38 amphib requirement, that requirement was always tied to a forcible entry operation involving, you know, two Marine Expeditionary Brigades. What you're doing is saying, and the rationale behind this is that scale of forcible entry operation is no longer required. Therefore, the 38 ship target is no longer required. The real risk to the Marine Corps is that, in terms of availability for operations and training, the Navy has never met the 38 ship requirement. So it might be briefed well on paper as far as readiness and status and all that, and you know, those ships may in fact exist, but they're not ready, they're not available, and so if we're in that world caught in the paradigm that readiness means availability, well, it's sort of a ridiculous requirement then, because it's never been met. So what needs to happen is a change in a requirement based on the current operating environment, projected future threat and future operating environment, and the lift needed to support that. Also, perhaps a redefinition of what readiness means. If we break that paradigm of readiness equals availability, so sort of a fight tonight and dance with whoever you brung approach, availability meaning readiness, and change that to answering what do we really need to be ready for, when do we need to be ready for that, and then what parts of our force need to be at that level of readiness. If we start to answer those questions, then there may be a positive solution in this.
But as we sit today, it's a very precarious place that the Marine Corps sits in, yes, with you know, this development, and yet no real clear, right, approved and funded path to a right. future vision, yes? Would that be fair?
That's an accurate and fair statement. I agree.
Got him. No, it's I don't think people, when you see that, you know, I don't think most people understand, you know, the implications of not building, the implication of, yeah, this would crush our shipbuilding capacity. So we have no surge capacity in that inventory. And then I just saw an article, I think, in the Early Bird today, where a congressional oversight group was critical of the Pentagon for a $700 million loan to a shipbuilding company. Oversight panel slams Pentagon for $700 million loan, saying that they used COVID-19 relief funds and excoriated the DOD over a $700 million loan to a troubled shipbuilding company. Now, I believe it's a shipbuilding company. I was going to say, look, I'm not going to defend the mechanism, but I would certainly defend the sentiment, because that infrastructure is incredibly vital to national security, and we, you know, this superpower can't surge shipbuilding. That's a problem. And so again, what these little deck big platforms were going to do, combined with the F-35, was give combatant commanders a lot more tools to do power projection, and not just a little bit of power, big power projection. And so the loss of one, the loss of 25% of that inventory out of the Marine Corps, and it not being replaced, it can't be overstated. Let's talk about the Marine Corps Gazette. You're having dog issues at your house too. That's good to know. First of all, is there a theme for this month, December? Does it have a theme?
So December, the whole magazine isn't themed, but there is a focus area, and I'll highlight it because it's something new. We've never We've never really done a focus on talent management before. And for future reference, this is going to become, talent management is already becoming one of what I'll call an evergreen topic, meaning you're going to see content related to that subject probably in every issue this coming year in 2021. It's one of those parts underlining or underpinning the vision in Force Design 2030 that folks are really getting their teeth into now, and also recognizing that the changes required when you start talking about talent management, and use that as an umbrella term for everything from manpower management, manpower policy, recruiting policy, some training, education, promotion, assignment, all of that together is an underpinning, a piece of talent management. Also, bear in mind that talent management is also used in discussions about diversity and cohesion, et cetera. In the Commandant's Planning Guidance and in Force Design 2030, we talk about the need to create this optimized force to do the things that we were just talking about, to meet that, to be ready for an emergent threat. We're really starting to see Marines writing on different aspects of this larger issue of talent management.
Interesting. I've got an email, and so let me pause this month, us talking about this month. Mac, I'm curious about Woody's observations about the LSD thing going on in the 2nd Marine Division. Pretty interesting article. I've spent a lot of time with 2nd Marine Division over the course of the last 2 years, and this has been an ongoing issue for them, trying to get the powers to be to test for LSD because they saw an uptick in activity. Now, Woody, you and I both know, and I'd be curious, your experiences as a commanding officer, but the Lance Criminal Network is pretty efficient. I mean, you talk about it can be nefarious. Most of the time it's harmless and humorous, but it can be nefarious. And one of the things that they traffic in is the knowledge about the urinalysis, what it screens for, what it does not. When I was a company commander, I had Marines taking narcotics. I didn't. They were in RCT-7. They were taking narcotics that were designed for animals because they knew that these drugs weren't tested for by the urinalysis. And I heard my Marines were telling me about it. I'm like, you got to be shitting me. I'm like, no, sir. One of these guys, dad's a veteran pharmacist in terms of veterinary stuff.
Veterinary pharmacist, yeah.
And so the brother sends him like narcotics essentially. But again, I use that to illustrate the point that Marines have long been very interested in what the urinalysis tests for and what it does not test for. Cocaine and meth, were drugs of choice because they get out of your system so quickly, right? And only dopes do marijuana, which stays in your system forever. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. You commanded at various levels of the Marine Corps.
Absolutely. No, I was actually a trained SACO when I was a
nice.
Yeah, I couldn't get out of that one. It's like being a combat cargo officer. I got that little bit too.
Jeff Kenny is still bitter about his days as with Will Costantini sentencing him to be the piss test officer.
Well, I mean, Constantine's a well-known stump gazer, so he would enjoy that duty, but the pecker checker. But the fact of the matter is, the urinalysis, no urinalysis tests for everything. You look at sort of most likely most dangerous, and the, you know, the government, the Department of the Navy, buys a urinalysis capability based on, you know, the number of personnel to be tested, and bases that on the types of drugs, the number of illicit drugs that are most likely to be abused. By definition, that test is not necessarily going to check for other drugs. One of the examples from my time as a company commander is Marines using illegally purchased steroids. Kid wants to get bigger, wants to get more gains in the gym, goes down to Mexico, buys some Deca or D-ball, and other Marines see that, learn about it. Sometimes it has some medical side effects, but you had to establish probable cause in order to do a urinalysis for that substance. The problem with the recreational drugs is it's very hard to establish probable cause, and more often than not, we're talking purely about unit sweeps. So everybody pees in a bottle, and those tests are limited by the cost involved of testing for everything.
Right.
Now, exacerbating the problem today is the so-called designer drugs. Variety of substances out there that like LSD are made in a lab. You know, they don't grow in the ground. They're not dried and fermented somewhere in the Korangal Valley or in Thailand, and they're not a natural substance. Those are in some cases even harder to identify and harder to test for. And in some cases, there's a law enforcement aspect where they're not even necessarily illegal. Again, the DEA bases, scheduling drugs as legal or illegal based on a chemical formula, and that one doesn't exist. It's changed routinely to make these various designer drugs. I think the move by General Donovan is smart, and I think the real challenge now is it's the from growing up in Brooklyn, we call it the cockroach factor. If you see one, you know there's more behind the sink. If 2nd Marine Division is having a problem with this, 1st and 3rd are having a problem with it too.
Right. The entire DOD, if you start, like you said, if you start flipping over the rocks.
That's it. And
I say this about, when bad things happen to units in combat, where they do bad things, and I use, the 3-5 example in Hamidiya, right? If you start flipping over rocks and follow those guys, that didn't start today, right? It there's been a pattern of that in most units. It doesn't just happen all of a sudden spontaneously combust. And this stuff is, in my opinion, the same. If you start looking around, if you start poking around, you will find this all over the DOD. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that with any pride, but again, I don't think it's any more than, the criminal elements that were just as active when we were on active duty are still there, and they're still looking for ways to if they want to get high, and they will, if there's a way, if there's a perceived way that they could do that and not get caught, that's where this energy will go. And so I don't think it's but I just want to make sure that everybody understands the reason we don't test for all these drugs across the spectrum is cost. Yes,
that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I don't know present day, what the increase in costs are to test for the more the less abused substances, let's call it that, the rarer use substances, but they were very expensive, you know, back in the early 2000s, late 90s. It was very expensive to do those sorts of tests, and you also had to have some legal justification as well.
Got it. All right, Woody, let's go back. I'm sorry. Let's go back to the December issue. Talent management. Explain to me the significance of these talent management articles vis-a-vis Forest Design.
So the lead-off article, it's actually a cover article, is by Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Chun, who was one of our CMC fellows at Yale. And he's writing at it from the perspective of the first-term alignment program, first enlistments, and how we use that, you know, turnover of roughly 33,000 Marines a year to find and
hey, just let me. People might not have understood what you just said, and it's stunning to people, right? It's stunning to people, and I go through this when we talk about suicide, right?
Right.
Everybody's perception of military suicide is what? Combat related. Oh, these guys must have fought. The reality is not combat related.
That's true.
Right? And so when you but if you don't know how much the Marine Corps turns over on an annual basis, you have no idea how quickly, you know, in a room of 1,000 people, if I say everybody who's been to an operational environment where you get shot at, put your hand up. In a room of a battalion of 1,000 people, there might be 50 that put their hand up. Might be. That's how fast this thing turns over.
That's right.
Right. And that's how many years we are away from battalions deploying to fight. And we don't realize it. And it's like what you're looking at is a non-combat Marine Corps for the most part. With some, you know, combat veterans sprinkled in there, but it's interesting because that is the perception of what happens.
That's right, and it does capture, you know, even Marines who have never looked at this problem and not problem, but looked at the reality in any detail. It seems odd to them, and because their frame of reference is pretty narrow. But yeah, about 33,000 Marines come in every year through the work of a recruiting command and the two recruit depots. And then about 33,000 leave the Marine Corps every year. And so to maintain that that stasis, you have to have a balance between accessions and attrition. What the article talks about is using that natural rhythm to better assess the Marines and develop the Marines who are staying past that first enlistment again, use that as a driver, the methodology to build this objective force that is described in Force Design 2030. So, you know, the phrase is harvest the high-hanging fruit that the author uses. In other words, use this natural rhythm to keep the best Marines. Identify, develop, and keep the best Marines.
Now, the rubber band, dare I say, is stretched pretty tight relative to the Marine Corps. And anybody who's done operational Marine Corps and seen like a MEF G3 operate with all the taskers, the MEF G3 is one, watch the MEF G1 operate. In terms of sourcing all the taskers that come down from on high, and the Marine Corps' inability to say, "Yeah, you know, we can't do that." Nobody says that, and so now the force is supposed to shrink. Look into your crystal ball, Woody. What the hell happens?
Well, you know, sooner or later, this is this goes back to the discussion or the comments I was making about readiness versus availability. There's a huge risk in changing that paradigm for a service like the Marine Corps. You know, we have always used the phrase most ready when the nation is least ready. Right. But when readiness equals availability, think about this: most available when the rest of the nation and its military are least available. That means you don't get to say no. That means you don't get to, quote unquote, prioritize and we're going to do this, but we're not going to do that. You're caught in an operating model where you've got to do the windows. Now, the results of that can be very risky. For a period of time, and you talk about the MEF G3, anecdotally from 3MEF's G3 several years ago, sooner or later you get to the point where you have 2 to 4 Marines in 50 different countries. And that's your capability, and that's what you're able to support theater engagement or theater security cooperation with. That is the potential going forward.
Yeah, good luck on that.
Yeah. Well,
that's, right, good luck on that. But it is. I think it's astounding for most people to understand, one, how young the Marine Corps is, two, how few officers the Marine Corps has, and three, how quickly the Marine Corps turns over. And then you try to, you say, okay, so how do we shine this penny up? And then the next piece is, as you begin to shine, oh, by the way, this rubber band, don't stand too close to it, because this son of a bitch is stretched about as tight as you could stretch it. And so when you're looking for nuance and ways to massage it, it's like you're a rat in this maze of blocked off complex, tunnels. And you keep running and you go down one, you're like, yeah, ultimately somebody standing there saying, you can't do that, because if you do that, you impact this, and this, and this obligation. And so give us a little hint. So what's the solution to all this that the authors come up with?
Well, I don't know that there is one solution. The author of that article looks at current promotion and retention policies. Subsequent articles talk to different aspects of the promotions process. I'd encourage in particular an article by Lieutenant Colonel Jason Heuer as sort of it's almost a primer. It's the insider view of what goes on in a promotion board. Very, very informative for Marines, because the majority of Marines will never sit on a promotion board.
Right.
Will never be in the boardroom. I don't know whether I consider myself lucky or unlucky, but I've got enough Quantico time as a colonel that I've been on a lot of promotion boards and a lot of selection boards and command selection boards. And it's important. I think if everyone understands that, it helps with a number of normal behaviors in terms of performance evaluation and mentoring in the Marine Corps. One other article that I'll point out that may get some comments, and I'd be surprised if it didn't, both pro and con, is written by Captain Thomas Haluska. And it's entitled Marine Corps Enlisted to Officer Programs. And essentially, the author's thesis is that for prior enlisted Marines, officer candidate school is an unnecessary second rite of passage.
Ooh.
So very out of the box thinking there, certainly not the party line, but he does a credible job of laying out some of the costs and benefits of essentially putting Marines who have already gone through recruit training, been through the crucible, already been awarded an Eagle, Open Anchor, and have become Marines through that rite of passage, and been through assignments and promotions, either in the active or reserve component, who then qualify for enlisted commissioning programs, to then have to go through a similar rite of passage at officer candidate school. It looks at it as a waste of resources, as unnecessary for those Marines, and so it's an interesting argument. I don't know that a lot of people are going to agree with it.
Well, the initial pushback will be is that, look, one of the things that is beautiful about the Marine Corps is our sameness. that you know if there's some, if there's a Marine officer, you know the path that they've gone through, and we all go through the same path. You know, we tend to have a common vision and a common origin, which I think goes a long way towards binding us to the things that we do. And now you're gonna cleave that.
And true, so, and yet, right? You know, but the
even
the,
our aviators, right? Even our aviators,
the, you know, the rest of the story,
right?
Not all Marine officers go through officer candidate school.
Oh, the, we're going to talk about them.
The Naval Academy does not, and ROTC midshipmen only do 6 weeks.
When did that change?
Not all the same.
I thought ROTC guys did the whole thing.
6 weeks. Not until that's 1 6-week summer for ROTC.
Well, there was a day when we had a Secretary of the Navy named Webb that.
That is correct.
When he had his way, all Naval Academy, they went through. And again, what was interesting about that was it was spawned by, according to Secretary Webb at the time, the low promotion rate, right, of Naval Academy graduates in the Marine Corps. Was it from first lieutenant to captain or captain to major? I mean, it was one of those. That like, yeah.
I think it was captain to major.
Yeah. And it was like, yeah, this is not good. That means they come here expecting something else. We need to further immerse them in the culture so they can make a good decision whether Marine option is a good or bad thing for them. Now, you know what? I love the discussion, Woody. So one of the cool things about having you on, like, well, is that actually a benefit?
Right.
Well, hell, let's think about it.
To your point, our sameness is, you know, and go on the record, that is one of the intangible strengths of our officer corps. But it's important to recognize that that sameness starts at the basic school, post-commissioning.
Interesting. Well, then I'll have to, like, I'll have to track that young man or woman down, and we'll have to have a conversation. Because that's interesting. That's interesting. I want to ask you, since we're talking, this popped into my head. Is it time for us to change the way we do recruit training?
I would say no. Talking specifically about Paris Island, San Diego, no. I don't think there's a, there are always improvements and some changes made around the margins. And that's a continuous process improvement, right. Function. Right. So yes, that's all valid. You can always do better. You can always do, course content reviews, curriculum reviews. You can always, modify the POI slightly. You can do more to standardize the two POIs between, the East and the West Coast. Because they're not the same. You can standardize where it makes sense. You can integrate where it makes sense, both in the recruits and in the instructor base, the drill instructors. But the reason I say it fundamentally does not need to change, is very much within the services often used as the standard for how initial entry-level training should be conducted. And I've got a little personal experience about that from my time as the G3, the Operations Officer of Training and Education Command. I was there after 2011, and if you recall, there was a fairly egregious misconduct incident that occurred at Lackland Air Force Base, which is essentially one of the Navy's, or correction, the Air Force's entry-level training installations. And part of the fix for that involved the Air Force trying to learn from the Marine Corps about how to do entry-level training and how to get their program healthy and safe and, some very, very basic things that we take for granted, having the oversight of commissioned officers involved in entry level training of 17, 18, 19-year-old recruits and staff NCO, more senior instructors. Having officers actually in charge of that was a big learning experience. And so that's why I say fundamentally it does not need change. However, just like any other process, it can benefit from lessons learned and improvements, along the way. But in its core, there's nothing wrong with it, I don't think.
Got it. Well, it's interesting you to go back to current events. I don't know, within the last month, I've seen articles about, shutting down both Parris Island and MCRD San Diego, building another facility because it would be cheaper than retrofitting, the retrofits you have to do.
I chuckled because 10 years ago we were doing the same analysis.
Right.
Years before that, we did the same analysis.
Really? What was the conclusion that it was just to complete the thought that with the as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, I believe of this year or last year, I'm not sure which one, is the language that, Marine Corps recruit training will become integrated, period.
Yes. Right?
And so that is now written in law. The Marine Corps has been given X number of years to make it happen. And so now we're looking at physical adjustments to the facilities in order to support that. How do you do that? And then some of the articles, prominent article that I saw, there was much ballyhooed. I didn't know if there was any truth to it, but.
Oh, there's truth. There's actually a couple of different problems involved in this. What you describe as far as efficiencies of having one depot, vice two, the infrastructure requirements, military construction requirements that go along with fully integrating barracks and training facilities. Those are there. And it becomes a cost benefit, very, very math oriented analysis there. And the costs are prohibitive. But the other problem underlying this is, eventual loss of Parris Island, to weather, to sea level, to natural disaster. Parris Island, it's sinking. It's not actually sinking, but there are several environmental concerns there. And, one severe or even a not severe hurricane forming out in the Atlantic with a projected track that takes it up through that area of coastal Carolina effectively shuts down training. And so recruits have to be moved, instructors, Marines, their families have to be moved, depending on where that track goes and how bad the storm is, they have to be moved further inland. All of that, has to be dealt with every single fall. It's like clockwork. It starts around the end of July, beginning of August.
But Woody, it's Parris Island. It's the sand fleas. It's the causeway. It's coming around the corner at night, right? It's the mythology of the Marine Corps. How do we cannot exist without Parris Island?
I know. Well, you mentioned the ballyhoo. I mean, the allergic reaction that happens instantly as soon as closing Parris Island. It's the end of the free world. But
a lot of that might be overblown hype. Okay. When you hear something being discussed, and then somebody say, that would be the end of the free world as we know it. This is not, though. The closing of Parris Island would appropriately fit into that category, right? When you go into the holy of holies of the Marine Corps, okay, you will bump into Chesty Puller's skeleton, and all kinds of other. You'll bump into Presley O'Banion's sword, the Iwo Jima flag raisers, and you will walk, it'll all be housed at Parris Island. Okay, that's the way that we do it. Oh my God.
The folks who do this are looking at the costs of what preservation of that particular piece of real estate entails in terms of flood control and drainage and hardening hardening structures and trying to protect it from the
bullshit thing. We just saw, not so much Paris Island, but, Camp Lejeune just got crushed, right? And the impact on families, on facilities was – and they couldn't get the funding to fix it, right?
Exactly.
And it was – it's no joke because – and that money was, you know, the first thing was physician, heal thyself. Find the money, Marine Corps.
Of course. That's always the answer.
Right? What?
Everyone has ever worked programs and budgets. No, that's always the first answer. You need to pay for something and figure out how to do it.
Right. When I have Will and Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny on, one of the questions I ask them before we end every day is, what are you reading now? And someone just suggested that I ask you that. Woody skews to the literate type. Ask him what he's reading this month. So Woody, what are you reading?
So two parts to that. Every single day of every month, I like to say I'm reading everyone's term paper because I'm reading everything that that comes over the transom into the Gazette editorial offices. For publication, I'm reading all the entries in our writing contests and that sort of thing. So I've got my a full plate of work reading to do. I do read some other defense journals and kind of see what the other folks in my publication space are reading. But so interestingly, for one reason or another, and you can draw your own conclusions as to why. And I've always been a partial reader of historical fiction, science fiction, that sort of thing. But for some reason, for the last few months, I've been reading some of it fairly old, going back to the 50s, apocalyptic science fiction. So end of the world books.
give us a title so people can check it out.
Okay. So Cormac McCarthy's The Road is exceptional, really, really well written. I mean, just remarkably well written book, but dark and very, I think some people would probably say depressing, upsetting book about, the end of the world, the big one, the great apocalypse, and no one knows exactly what caused it, but this is not a few days after. This is several years after. And so, all the food is run out. Anybody who was a prepper, well, they burned through all their supplies. There's one bullet left in the gun. And now what?
Is Mel Gibson a part of any of this at all?
No, but they did make a movie. I've never seen it, but they did make a movie out of that book.
Really?
A few years back. Viggo Mortensen was the star of that.
Yeah, you bet. Hey, I want to ask you, I have not read any of his books, but everybody I hear speak of the work of Ian Toll raves about it. Have you read any of his stuff?
No, I have not. I have not. But I have heard the same reviews. Very, very good writer. You got to draw your own conclusions. So, I have not read his work, so I'm not going to comment there.
All right, Woody, tell everybody where they find your magazine and admonish them to become members.
So www.mcamikecharliealpha-marines.org, if you're if you're an active Marine, there's an awful lot on that site that's free to you, you're encouraged to become a member so that you can get your hard copy, your paper copy of the magazine, and access to everything that we've got online. I will highlight one thing online this month. Sergeant Major Black wrote a letter for us. It was actually published as an email to the force, and then we hung it out on our website as an article, and it'll appear in the January print magazine. But if you're a Marine and you haven't read it, you need to. It's the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps' non-negotiables, and I think for us veteran types, this stuff is fairly intuitive. Some of it may not be. So I encourage all Marines to read that letter from Sergeant Major Black, and particularly if you're still wearing the uniform, a word to the wise. Might want to crack that open.
Well, you know, one of the guardrails of post-traumatic winning is self-discipline. And, you know, it's and one of the things I say when I talk about it is that, you know, you control that choice 100%. And I play a video that Will Smith stars in. And I say, you know, there's a lot of cool people on the planet. Not too many people that cooler than Will Smith, you know. And he's achieved the highest award that you can receive in the artistic genre of filmmaking, in the artistic genre of television, you know, episodic TV, and then as a recording artist. And if you listen to him talk, there were always people that were more talented than him. And the secret to his success, he would tell you, is his self-discipline in the way he devoted himself to his work. And that's why people have been consistently willing to invest millions of dollars in him to deliver a return on that investment. And so to me, again, you control it 100%. And it will define in no matter what you choose to do, artist, athlete, if you become a CEO or if you're a garbage man, you cannot be a sustained success at anything if you don't embrace self-discipline. You simply cannot. You may happen upon success, but you will happen upon failure shortly thereafter. And so, you know, when you read these things and it's sitting, you know, very prominent on the Gazette's website right now, you'll bump into it relatively quickly. His yes. Non-negotiables. Those things are the keys to living a great life. You may not realize it. You may not want to embrace it. You know, kind of intimidating guy, blah, 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 blah. But let me tell you, there is a path to success. There is a path to a great life. And if you won't embrace it, then you're going to spend, you know, probably far too much time in a ditch. And you're going to be in that ditch on a relatively frequent basis. So word to the wise. Word to the wise.
Hey, one real quick save sure. round, and it prompted me just some free advice for anyone who you know wants to know if whether they want to read Ian Toll's trilogy on the World War II. We've got reviews of all his work in the Gazette. So if you search through our website, you'll find well written book reviews of the first two. Books in the series, and then the last one, Twilight of the Gods, will be running a review of that very soon. So, Conquering Tide and Pacific Crucible are they're pretty well reviewed on our magazine and on our website.
All right, so all you got to do is go to mca-marines.org, and on the search window, type in Ian Toll. And you will see the reviews, and they are—they're up there right now. I'm looking at them. So, well, thank you very much for that, Woody. And let me tell you—I would tell you—you you hear a lot of the books that we talk about. You know that you know Will's a reader. Jeff is known prominently as a book stealer, and also a reader. And then Tim Lynch is a reader. I tend to be like Woody. I tend to be bogged down in current operations, and I don't have as much time to read books as I used to. But no, I would tell you the books that you hear those guys talk about, go to the MCA website and check out somebody who's already read it, you know, that has kind of a similar bias that we have. And I would tell you to do that. The other thing I would always tell you to check out is the Gazette blog. They've got some very, very, very interesting stuff there. And most prominent is, Race in the Marine Corps. Let's have a discussion. And so let's talk about him. And so I think that that stuff's important. And I think Woody's doing a great job with it. So, Woody, thank you very much. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holidays to you and yours. And I'll talk to you again in January.
All right, Max. Same to you. Stay safe.
All right, bud. See you. There you have it. I love talking current events with Woody. Again, he occupies a very prominent position in the Marine Corps as the editor and publisher of the Gazette and the publisher of Leatherneck magazine. But I think you heard the concern from him relative to the decision, right, not to replace the Bonhomme Richard, and also, national security issue. When we can't surge shipbuilding capability, that's no bueno, boys and girls. So that'll do it on a Monday. If you're just tuning in, you just heard Chris Woodbridge, and we had a conversation about General Mattis's op-ed. On the mark, off the mark? Does the audio not match the video? And we talked about Saudi Arabia, Israel, coalescing in this Middle East thing, to essentially confront Iran. Talked about China. Talked about the Bonhomme Richard being first decommissioned and then scrapped. And then the Navy decision, as you said, as you heard Woody say, this decision cannot be overstated in terms of magnitude for the Marine Corps, right? That the Bonhomme Richard will be decommissioned, scrapped, but will not be replaced. And understanding what the Bonhomme Richard was it had a flight deck that had been retrofitted for the F-35 Bravo. And what class of ship is it? It is a WASP class amphibious assault ship. And so when you, again, the big difference between the Bonhomme Richard and other platforms is that it has the flight deck on top, the short deck, right, relative to a full-size United States Navy aircraft carrier. And then in the back, it has a well deck. Okay. And so, anyway, the decision not to replace it is a big one. So we talked about that. Talked about LSD, and then we talked about this month's Gazette, which has a number of articles related to talent management and getting the most bang out of the force. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. We check news headlines here in hour number one. It's on a Wednesday. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. It's a pretty good time, not going to lie to you. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, out.